Thank you, Celine. Thanks for the invitation. I'm very happy to be back at FPI, even if it's virtual. Always a fun crowd. Please interrupt me anytime with any questions. I know online seminars, people are getting bored of them. So, you know, let's spice it up with your questions. So today I would like to talk about a topic, I guess, close to many of your interests, which is symmetries. And in particular, I am looking at symmetries in the cosmological context. So let's sort of start at the beginning, you know, zoom out, get the big picture. Right. So in GR and pretty much like all over physics, right, an invaluable tool that we have is perturbation theory. So in particular, I mean, anytime in GR we want to solve something, or anytime, well, often we like to consider, you know, some kind of metric where we introduce some background metric with small perturbations, where this could be like Minkowski spacetime, the Kerr spacetime, FRLW, and then we want to understand, you know, the what happens in such a system. However, right, generically, if you give me the left-hand side, you give me an arbitrary metric, there is no canonical split, right? If, you know, I look at the output of a numerical simulation of, you know, two black holes colliding with each other, there's no, you know, background metric and small perturbations. And even if you were to make such a choice, which of course you can, then there is no, you know, canonical way to do it. Like I may choose a different background metric than you do. So that, you know, is somewhat problematic. So what do we do in GR? Well, there is one way to get around of all of this, and this is to go, you know, from your messy physical realm, like say these two black hole mergings, maybe there's even like matter flowing around, you know, you have accretion disk or neutron stars, all of that. As a theoretician, what you do is you run as fast as you can, all the way to Scry, where you can do your theoretical experiments. So how does this work? Well, you have to run to Scry in a very particular way, right? So there are different types of infinities. Actually, you have to run to infinity in different kinds of ways, sorry. So there are different types of infinities. In particular, right, I can keep my spatial position fixed and send time to infinity. So then I would end up at spatial infinity, or I could fix my time and send my radial coordinate to infinity, in which case I would end up at spatial infinity, or I could go to infinity along null rays. So those are the two infinities that I'm not interested in, but the one that I'm interested in is along those null rays, which gets me to the radiation zone. Or in terms of the notation I introduced, that would be Scry. So how to do this mathematically, right? We don't really like infinities, or I mean, maybe some people do, but you know, most people don't like to work with infinities. So the idea is to bring infinity to a finite distance. And the way to do that is to say, okay, well, I have my manifold with my physical metric on it. What I'm gonna do is even though, you know, that boundary where my infinity is, right? For instance, right, in the Minkowski spacetime, the points are at or equal to infinity are not part of your spacetime, right? Because that's where your metric diverges. But we're gonna say, okay, let's include those points, right? So I have now a bigger manifold. And since I want these, the metric to be well-defined also at those points at infinity, what I do is I rescale my physical metric with some conformal factor that absorbs those infinities. So you can just think of that omega as just being 1/r, so that the metric at r equals infinity, this conformally rescaled metric at r equals infinity is now finite. So this technique goes by the name of a conformal completion and is very useful in this story. So in particular, right, if you do that, say, the conformal rescaling and look at, I mean, flat spacetime, Minkowski spacetime, you can draw like a formal diagram, right? And here you see all the different infinities, and in particular, right, this region, the radiation zone, Scry, is of interest to us. Now, of course, flat spacetime is a bit boring, right? We like, you know, some more physical, realistic cases, like, you know, the merging black holes I was describing, or neutron stars, or, you know, other types of interesting, fun spacetimes. So what we do, or what we can do, is describe this large class of really fun spacetimes, you know, that seem interesting to us, which we call asymptotic flat spacetimes. And this is the definition. So let me take you through it. Right. So what we say is we're going to do this trick of a conformal completion. So we're going to consider all physical spacetimes that we can attach this boundary to. So we can have this conformally completed spacetime where the boundary of that spacetime has a particular type of topology. So it has to be R cross S2. And we require that, you know, there exists a conformal factor such that the rescaled metric is smooth on all of the spacetime. And we choose it also to be zero at that boundary. So this is the hat sign means that we're looking at points restricted to the boundary. And we require that the gradient of this conformal factor is nowhere vanishing on scrying. Now, up until this point, right, we've just done math. There's no physics. There's no differential geometry. It's just differential geometry. There's nothing to do with GR or anything like that. So, of course, that comes in the second point. So we require, of course, Einstein's equations are satisfied. And we're interested in asymptotically flat spacetime. So that means, right, that somehow we want to capture this idea that as you go towards infinity, your spacetime becomes more and more flat, right? So that means that your curvature has to die off, or in other words, that your stress energy tensor has to decay. And in particular, you know, you can phrase that in terms of coordinates, or you can phrase this in terms of these conformal factors, and you say that omega to the power minus 2 times the stress energy tensor needs to have a smooth limit to scry. So this allows us to define this large class of spacetimes that we can now study very nicely. So in particular, what is cool about this definition, or what I think is cool about this definition, that you immediately have some interesting consequences. So if you look at Einstein's equations, they tell you that, you know, it just follows from the definition that now this normal vector to scry has to be null on scry. So it's not something you put in, right? It is a consequence. So that also means, right, that this diagram that I sort of drew to capture this asymptotic flat spacetimes, say, you know, it's not by accident that this is a line of 45 degrees. It is a proper null surface. Related to that, right, once you know that the null vector is, or the normal vector is null, then you can also quickly figure out that that means that the induced metric on scry has to be degenerate. Now, you may be a bit, well, intrigued because, or confused maybe at this point, because it seems that, right, if I choose a particular omega that is zero on scry, if you choose, say, 100 times omega, you know, as your omega, that will also be zero on scry. So it seems like you have a lot of freedom in this whole construction. And that, you know, many people may not like, but that freedom, you can either restrict it or you just live with it. And in fact, you know, I think that freedom is just there, right? So if I choose an omega in this definition and you choose a different omega, which, you know, depends on, it's actually, you know, not just a rescaling by some number, but it's a complete functional freedom on the two sphere, essentially, that is an equally valid choice. It means that you get a different induced metric and a different null vector. Right? And in particular, they scale in this particular way. So the metric, of course, would scale with omega squared. And the normal vector with the index raised up will be with a factor of omega to the power minus one. And that to the power minus one is important to keep in mind, because we'll see that in the cosmological context, this is going to be slightly different. So just keep that in mind. Now, this this normal vector and this induced metric that are both null, they are common to all asymptotically flat spacetimes, up to, of course, a conformal freedom. And so that means in particular, right, if you know you look at the Minkowski spacetime and you look at the induced metric on Sky, it will be identical to, say, the induced metric on Sky of a Kerr spacetime, which is also asymptotically flat, or of some other type of example, such as a particular Weil metric or things like that. They will all have the exact same induced metric and normal vector. So this is actually common to all asymptotically flat spacetimes. Now, of course, not all asymptotically flat spacetimes are the same, right? The whole point is that you can describe a large class of spacetimes that are different. So they may differ, for instance, in whether there's mass or not, whether there are gravitational waves, etc. All these things are encoded not in this universal structure, but in the next order structure. So for instance, in particular, right, gravitational radiation is encoded in that next order structure. But all asymptotically flat spacetimes do share this universal structure. So just to quickly recap this part, right? Nowhere in this construction did we introduce a split of the background and gravitational waves or anything like that, right? This split naturally occurs at non-infinity, where we have the universal structure sort of acting as a background, and the first order structure is what contains gravitational radiation, mass, and all these other things. And this description is, you know, completely, fully nonlinear. Nowhere, right, did I introduce an epsilon or anything like that. I think this is absolutely beautiful, and I hope you think so too. Now, you may have learned about asymptotic flatness differently, not using this geometric description, but an approach based on coordinates, which is essentially, you know, this story. Let me bring some structure to all of this. What you do is, right, you can say, if you can write your metric in this form, right, in the top form, you can always write your metric in this form where you just have u, v, gamma, and w are all arbitrary functions of these if you want theta and phi coordinates. But now, you know, that's for any four-dimensional metric. But now you say, okay, well, I'm not interested in any four-dimensional metric. I want it to be an asymptotically flat one. So what you then say is, well, I demand that these u, v, which in principle are arbitrary functions, to decay in a particular way as I approach phi. So what you say is, for instance, right, that at leading order, these functions should have the exact same form as in flat space. So you get this yellow part. And then of course, you know, you don't want exactly flat space. So for instance, the mass aspect is hidden in this, this part of your V expansion, where this M can just depend not just on, or, you know, it's not just a constant, right? But it can also depend on these other coordinates, U and theta and phi. Similarly, gravitational radiation is encoded in this expansion up here. And we also have the angular momentum aspect, which is encoded in this particular component. So anytime you can write the metric that you are interested in these type of coordinates, and you find that they decay in this particular way, you know that you have an asymptotically flat spacetime. And you can also work with that. So these two definitions are in fact completely equivalent. So, you know, if you start with the geometric description that I showed you, Penrose and others, based on this conformal completion, you can derive how the coordinates should look like. And in particular, you get these Bondi sex coordinates that I showed you. Now, what to do with this asymptotically flat spacetimes, and what to do in particular with that universal structure? Well, the universal structure gives us a way to study these spacetimes all, you know, in one go, and allows us to define something that we call the asymptotic symmetry algebra. So generically, right, a random spacetime that's asymptotically flat will have no symmetries at all, right, unless you look at very specific examples. But far away, right, we recover this universal structure that is very much like, you know, the one in flat spacetime. So you should not be surprised that asymptotically you do see something that looks like a symmetry. And in fact, we call these asymptotic symmetries. So again, since we have these two different equivalent definitions, we can of these asymptotically flat spacetimes, right? This more geometric approach and the coordinate approach, we can also define or look for the asymptotic symmetries in two different ways. So we can either say in the geometric approach, well, let's look at all the vector fields that leave the universal structure invariant. So that map, you know, any Q to a conformally related Q, and that map, and that Lie Dirac that Lie Dirac my null vector field, so that, you know, I remain null. That is one way of describing the universals or describing the asymptotic symmetries. A completely equivalent way is to look at the coordinates and say, well, you know, let's just look at, well, if you want a Killing-like equation, right? This is just the equation for a Killing vector field. If this were true everywhere in space-time, but now we say, okay, this only has to be true at infinity, and we include this extra factor of omega squared for things to be well-defined. And what you then find is if you look at these symmetries, you find the BMS symmetry algebra that probably many of you are very familiar with by now, since it is such a booming business, so to say, these last years. And this symmetry algebra is bigger than the Poincaré algebra, right? So the Poincaré algebra is, well, essentially consists of translations and Lorentz rotations and boosts, but the BMS case also has super translations. So the key part is that these super translations, what is super about them is that they're not just very particular functions here that you multiply with your partial U vector field, but they can be any arbitrary function on the two sphere. So a translation would just be a linear combination of, if you were to decompose this vector, or this function into spherical harmonics, a translation would just be only looking at the first spherical harmonics with, you know, L equals zero and L equals one, but a super translation can be an arbitrary function there. Now you may ask, okay, why do I care? You know, what am I supposed to do with these symmetries? Well, I mean, classical GR, I think the answer is, well, or at least to me, is that it provides quantities with a physical interpretation. So in particular, right, if I look at the BMS algebra and I look at the translation subgroup, if I look at, say, charges, I can use those translations to define something like mass and linear momentum, and as well as their associated fluxes. I can look at the rotation subgroups and call something angular momentum. I can look at super translations and link this to memory effects. In fact, actually also some of the rotation things have been linked to spin memories and all of these things. So I see a question, I think.
Yes, so the question is like, what does not the BMS algebra contain, the stuff like super rotation?
So I am restricting, good. So you can enlarge the BMS algebra to also include super rotations. I have not done that here. And the reason why I did not do that, because I looked at vector fields that, smooth vector fields that, you know, preserve also the smoothness of my induced metric. But if you're willing to include vector fields that sort of diverge at specific points on your two sphere, then the BMS algebra would be larger and you would also have super rotations. That's correct. In the original work in the 70s, people did exclude those super rotations. I also prefer to work with smooth items, but if you're willing to let go of that, sure, you have this larger, even larger BMS.
But on that isn't like you're fixing QAB, right? Or is it probably coming from the fact that QAB it cannot vary, right? Like the
My QAB is Well, free up to conformal transformations.
Okay.
But well, free, it's flat up to conformal transformations.
Okay.
That is a requirement, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
And I require my QAB to be smooth, but if you don't require that,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's something you put into the definition. If I don't require that, I most likely am considering even larger class of space times.
Okay. Yeah. The chat, the person is happy, so.
Now, of course, I think there are even many more interesting applications of, you know, BMS in, say, you know, if you want to consider things like quantum gravity and you know, take the road forward. And I will not speculate there because I know you guys are much more experts than I am. I've also know that Laurent, for instance, has used BMS, well, extended version of BMS to as an input to rederive Einstein's equations. So there's many, you know, many things that BMS is good for, but this is just my answer within classical simple GR, so to say. Now, of course, in all this story, I had a critical assumption, and that is always that, you know, this idea that as I move far away from my sources, my gravitational wave sources, space-time becomes flat. And that was very powerful, right? Because then, you know, I got to do these 1/r expansions, I got this Bounding Stack coordinates, I get the Bounding New sensor, I get my BMS, all the good stuff. However, expanding space-times are not asymptotically flat, right? For instance, if we just consider the canonical example of an FRLW spacetime, right? By construction, it's homogeneous. So that means that, well, at least on a given time slice, every point is the same as every other one, right? So there's no decay of curvature in any sense, right? The curvature is the same at every point. So these spacetimes are clearly not asymptotically flat. So then why are we always assuming asymptotic flatness? And in fact, this is not a question that I asked, but it was already asked in the 60s at this famous conference in Warsaw, where Weber asked this question. And you can look back at the conference proceedings and Bergman answered, you know, this very honest theoretical physicist answer, well, you know, the only answer I can give is that the investigations date back less than 2 years and people have simply started with the mathematically simplest situation, which, you know, is a good approach typically, you know, that's how you make progress. And Bondi added to that, well, you know, I regret it as much as you do that we haven't gotten yet to the point of doing the Friedman universe. So that's essentially something that we set out to do quite some years later. Now, if you look at the Friedman universe, right, in expanding spacetime, there are two classes of spacetimes that are very different and that need to be considered separately. So if you have an expanding spacetime whose scale factor is, you know, expanding faster and faster, like, you know, the scale factor for our current universe and any spacetime, you know, that has a cosmological constant will eventually enter into this phase, those classes of spacetime are accelerating and are very different from those with a decelerating scale factor, you have, you know, the standard example is the matter dominated universe or radiation dominated universe. And in particular, if you look at these two classes, right, the radiation zones are very different. So this is a spacetime which has a decelerating scale factor, right? So in which case the radiation zone is still a null surface. And if you have an accelerating expansion rate, then your spacetime will have a radiation zone ascribed that is not a null surface, but that is space-like. So I'm not considering this class for now, but I'm focusing on the decelerating spacetimes. And in particular, right, let's study the canonical example of an FRLW spacetime. So if I write the physical metric as a scale factor times the flat metric, where the scale factor you can write as, you know, some power of the conformal time, then if I look at this S, if this S is between 0 and 1, your spacetime is decelerating. So what does that mean physically? What, you know, what is the range of S between 0 and 1? Well, it turns out S is related to W, and W is this thing that relates the pressure and the energy density of your perfect fluid. So just to get a little bit of feeling, for this, W is 1 for a stiff fluid, W is 1/3 for a radiation filled universe, it's 0 for a matter filled universe, which we modeled by dust, and it's -1 for if you treat the cosmological constant as a perfect fluid. So in particular, when S is between 0 and 1, that means that W is between -1/3 and infinity. So all of these cases, except the cosmological constant case, this are, you know, fall into this class of decelerating FRLW spacetimes. Now, to understand these spacetimes a bit better, the way to go forward is to, you know, make a conformal diagram. Now, as you can imagine, right, the conformal diagram, to draw that one, all you need is to understand the conformal structure. And since this metric is conformally equivalent, right, it's just a conformally rescaled of the flat metric, you could already know, or you can already see essentially, that the conformal diagram of the spacetime should be the same as that of a flat metric. With this important caveat, right, that in these spacetimes, right, this eta parameter doesn't go from -infinity to +infinity, but is restricted. Right? In the flat case, it goes all the way from -infinity to +infinity, but now you only have, you go from 0 to infinity or from -infinity to 0, depending on how you choose your time. So that means that you essentially, if you go through all the math, which you can do, right? You can follow, in fact, actually, you can just look at an appendix in Sean Carroll's GR textbook. You can go do all these, you know, conformal rescalings, all that. You look for a conformal factor, you conformally complete your spacetime, and indeed you find that the metric now looks like that of a flat metric. And this is your conformal diagram, essentially half of, you know, the Minkowski diagram, as we expected based on this fact that it's conformally related to the flat metric. And in particular, what is nice, right, if we study this conformal factor, we see that infinity, the radiation zone, is exactly whenever V equals to pi. And there also nicely, your conformal factor is 0, as you would expect. But near Scry, there's something weird going on, actually. So if we look a little bit closer at this omega, and if we expand, you know, near V equals pi, right? So to be close to Scry, we see that omega, you know, has this type of expansion, and that the gradient of omega is given like this. Now you may say, okay, that's all fine. But that means, right, that omega is not smooth on Scry, because S, you know, is, you know, you get some fractional power here. And if you evaluate the gradient of omega on Scry, so if you evaluate, you know, you insert V equals pi, you see that the gradient is exactly 0 on Scry, unless S equals 0. And that's a bit, well, problematic in the sense that if I wanted to sort of redo this whole, you know, defining this nice large class of space times using this geometric approach that we've seen before, sort of the two key ingredients in that approach were that we required that omega had to be smooth, right? And that this gradient should be nowhere vanishing on Scry. Exactly these two conditions are violated. Now you may say, okay, well, but maybe you just simply made a bad choice for this omega in this explicit example. You should just use a different omega. Like, consider omega prime, and which is related to your bad omega, and absorb all the badness, you know, in this little omega, so that your new omega prime is now smooth and its gradient is nowhere vanishing. And you can do that. And it looks so great. However, of course, there's a problem with that. Because then if I now look at the new metric, the new conformally completed metric, now this is the one that diverges on SCRI because I get some, you know, power to the power here, pi minus v to the power minus 2s, 1 minus s, which means that this diverges. So somehow, you know, you've put all the badness of this new, of this omega, right, that was in the omega, you've now, you know, shifted it to the metric. And the whole point of this, you know, technique of conformal completion was to go and work with, you know, nice smooth fields and, you know, not having to deal with infinities floating around everywhere. So it seems like, you know, at this point, you're at an impasse. And the question is what to do. In fact, it turns out there is a remarkably simple solution. And that is just by realizing that if you look at omega and you look at the power one minus omega to the power one minus s, you see that it is smooth. That's SCRI. And in particular, right, if, well, this is smooth, it's also, well, you can just calculate, but you see that it's zero on SCRI and that its gradient is nowhere vanishing. So the key is to just keep the same omega for your conformal completion, right, so that you use to conformally complete the metric, but use this omega, the omega to the power one minus s, to define a normal vector. Right? Because anytime something is, you know, normal, if, you know, the gradient of omega is normal to SCRI, then also the gradient of omega to the power one minus s is normal to SCRI. So that's what we do. And in particular, actually, we rescaled by power of one over one minus s, but that's not critical. And in particular, right, you can just look at this in detail and look at these expansions near v equals pi, and you see that this is really very nicely defined near SCRI, and it's nowhere vanishing. So now we're in business. But before we can generalize this class of asymptotically flat spacetimes to the cosmological context, we need to think a little bit about the presence of matter. Right? Because in the case for asymptotically flat spacetimes, right, we require that omega to the power minus 2 t hat ab should have a smooth limit to SCRI, which just meant, right, we want the matter to decay as we go towards infinity. But as I said, right, FOLW spacetimes are homogeneous, so that means that there's matter everywhere. So you cannot require that it should decay in a particular rate. In fact, actually, if you calculate the behavior of t hat ab for FOLW spacetimes, you find that it is indeed not just not decaying, but it is non-vanishing. So for instance, right, if you look at the trace, you find that it's given by, you know, this particular expression. But it's not just non-vanishing. In fact, if you look not just at the trace, but at particular components, you see that it's in fact also diverging. So it's worse than that. And these are the diverging parts. So there is a part that is universal in the sense that it's completely independent of the conformal factor that you've chosen, right? And just, you know, you can see that this is diverging, right? Because omega goes to zero on SCRI and S is a number between zero and one. So this, you know, will diverge. And here we have a subleading diverging part that's also up there. This does depend on your choice of omega, which just means that that tau A that we've defined here will also depend on your choice of omega. So it rescales in a particular type of way. And then they're finite terms. So how to deal with that? Well, you know, we can just define a class of spacetimes with a cosmological null asymptote. We sort of copy-paste the case of asymptotically flat spacetimes, but, you know, with these two important changes, right? We have now a different normal vector, right, with this omega to the power minus s, so that we didn't have to deal with that problematic part where it was vanishing everywhere on SCRI. And now instead of requiring that stress energy tensor decays, we demand that its trace exists and that its divergent pieces are only, you know, in the normal direction, and its subdivergent pieces in of this type of form. And then we can now look at the class of asymptotic symmetry algebras of this newly defined class of spacetimes. Now, of course, right, this is a new class of spacetimes, which are modeled after FRLW spacetime. But of course, they're much larger than just FRLW spacetime, right? We already know what the symmetries are of FRLW spacetimes. We don't, you know, need this fancy way of conforming and completing and all that, right? So this will allow us to study a much larger class of spacetimes. And while we have not proven that, but you know, hopefully also spacetimes that, you know, describe situations where we have, say, a cosmological spacetime with black holes in it, or cosmological spacetimes with gravitational waves in them, etc. So we hope that, you know, these are is an interesting large class of spacetimes. So it seems reasonable, you know, as one of the first things to do is let's study its asymptotic symmetries, in particular asymptotic symmetry algebra, right? Which in the geometric approach are just all the, well, in my opinion, the smooth vector fields, but you know, you could relax that, right? So you could also look at any vector fields that map my conformal or my universal structure, right? So the induced metric and the normal vector that I get to another one that is conformally related to these of the my, yeah, well, that are conformally related to these. And what you find is maybe not so surprisingly that you get something that's very similar to the BMS algebra, but there is this subscript S, there is like some S dependence. And that S dependence is critical. In particular, what is that S dependence? What does it do? Well, in terms of the coordinates on Scry, this S dependence shows up here. Well, whatever, not particularly important. There's some vector of S, you know, no one really cares. But it also shows up here in the super translations in a sort of hidden way. So again, this we have super translations and they're, you know, just arbitrary functions on the two sphere. But now these arbitrary functions on the two sphere have a particular type of property. They now have a conformal weight of one plus S instead of just one, which is the case for the asymptotically flat context. So why is that? Right. So if, you know, I look at a fixed super translation, I can write that as some function times the normal vector. And if I look at it in a different frame, right, I have a new f prime and a new n. But now because this new n, as you can imagine, it doesn't transform with omega to the power minus one, but with omega to the power minus one minus s. Now, that means that this f prime has to absorb that part so that, you know, these super translations are, you know, the same independent of your conformal frame. So that means that f prime transforms in this particular kind of way. Now you may say, okay, well, who cares about the conformal weight of some function? You know, I never really bother looking at that. What is that good for? Well, actually, it has some key consequence. In particular, it means that there's no preferred translation subalgebra. So very similar to the asymptotically flat case, where you have no preferred rotation group, you also, in this context of these larger class of space times, there's no preferred translation subalgebra. So that means that, you know, you don't have any special vector fields out of these subtrans or out of these, you know, infinite dimensional super translations to say, okay, let's call that vector field a time translation. And let's call, you know, that one a translation in, say, the XYZ direction, which also means that you don't have a preferred way of defining something like mass and linear momentum. No, you may say, well, that's all fine. I just, you know, deal with all these, with this lack of preferredness, so to say, right? And in the asymptotically flat context, we also don't have angular momentum, right? We have angular momentum up to all these super translation ambiguities. It's similar, or and similar, that's what we have here. So maybe you can say, oh, I don't care, but you know, on the other hand, you can, this at least does cast some doubt on, you know, what should we call mass and what should we call linear momentum. And for those experts that study asymptotic symmetries in all kinds of different contexts, it also turns out that these asymptotic symmetries are turn out to be equivalent to the conformal Carroll algebra with this particular N. I'm no expert on conformal Carroll algebras, but you know, if you are, then you already know exactly what this is. Now, sometimes I get this question, okay, wait, but you know, we know that FLW spacetimes have a bunch of symmetry. So what you're telling me about, you know, having no preferred translation subalgebra, isn't that in contradiction with FLW spacetimes having killing vector fields? And of course it's not, right? Also in asymptotically flat context, right? It's very similar, right? In asymptotically flat context, if I look at Schwarzschild, obviously I have, rotation killing vector fields. But if I look at the large class of spacetimes, right? If I study all asymptotically flat spacetimes at the same time, then I don't have any preferred rotations, right? Then I do have to live with this super translation ambiguity. And similar, that's the case here. So it could be that one member of this large class of spacetimes does have some extra symmetries, but the large class of spacetimes does not.
Beatrice, a question in the chat. So the question is like, this FRW universe, I think, is your background. Did this means that at null infinity, we should be able to recover the FRW metric? How to see this? I'm not sure.
So I have not really introduced the background, right? Similarly, in the asymptotically flat context, I'm not really introducing any backgrounds. Right. So, but I do agree with the if you were to look for a set of coordinates, right, and look at, say, the Bondi-Sachs coordinates, and you look at the expansion asymptotically flat case, it does look like, you know, flat space times plus, you know, corrections that of 1/r. In this context, you can also construct Bondi-Sachs like coordinates, and in that case, you know, as what you find is also that you get indeed something like FRLW spacetimes at leading order with subcorrections. So that intuition is indeed correct. And you would see that if you go to very explicit coordinates. I hope that answered the question of whoever asked it.
Yes, I think so. I say thank you.
If not, please ask more questions. Now, indeed, actually, if you introduce, there's one consequence also of, calculation that's nice to do in coordinates, or you can do it somewhat more geometrically, and that is to look at the Newman-Penrose scalars, which in asymptotically flat case have a beautiful hierarchy, right? There's generically, you find something that's called peeling. And in particular, in this context, in asymptotically flat case, you find peeling if all of these things are zero on scrying. But what you see here in this case, these are not zero on scrying, right? There's all kinds of tau terms, and these tau terms have to do with those, with the presence of matter, right? They're a result of the fact that the stress energy tensor doesn't decay. And because of that, it means that there's no peeling in this large class of spacetimes. Doesn't mean that there's something wrong, you know, there's no, you know, theorem that tells us that peeling is holy, but it does mean, you know, well, that we lose this nice property, which was also very helpful in sort of helping to think through, what is gravitational radiation, what's not, you know, where is it hidden, and all of these other things. And you know, we lose that in this larger class of spacetimes. Now, one other very important question to ask, right, is that, okay, I have defined a large class of spacetimes, but how large is that class? Do you have, you know, any other examples other than the exact FLW spacetimes? And the answer is, well, I don't have any explicit analytic examples, but we have an argument that allows us to conclude that the class of spacetimes that we've defined is at least as large as the class of asymptotically flat spacetimes. So we know that there are many solutions, and the argument, well, actually, let me not take you through it. There is a nice argument to make it, which is based also on you know, conformal transformations and all of these things. Unfortunately, what this argument doesn't tell us, it just tells us that there are many solutions that fall within this class, but it doesn't tell us, you know, whether those solutions are physically interesting, right? So it doesn't tell us, you know, that those stress energy tensors of those spacetimes, for instance, satisfy the dominant energy conditions or the weak energy conditions or any energy conditions at all. It doesn't tell us whether these spacetimes have gravitational waves in them or not. None of those things, you know, are guaranteed, but at least it's a large class of spacetime, so it's something to be hopeful about. So I think that's exciting. Now, again, I should mention, right, there is one important caveat. We have not shown that this definition is stable under linearization. Now, in the asymptotically flat case, that proof also was rather difficult and had to wait until the work of Garage and Santoupalos had to, you know, go to a very particular kind of gauge to prove this. And it was very important to prove this because that, you know, allowed you to conclude that gravitational waves are really part of the class of asymptotically flat spacetimes. We don't have such a proof yet. And it has to do with the fact that, well, there's matter flowing around at infinity, which makes all the calculations a lot more difficult and harder to check, etc. But in principle, or, you know, the hope is that this can be done. So let me conclude. Gravitational radiation and symmetries and all that can be studied using asymptotics in the full nonlinear theory, right? So no split of background plus perturbations. And I think in particular, right, this asymptotic symmetry algebra that you get by using this large class of spacetimes provides charges and fluxes with a physical interpretation. And in the asymptotically flat context, we got these BMS symmetries. And in this cosmological class of spacetimes, we don't exactly get BMS, but we get BMS-like symmetries, with this like referring to the fact that there now is no preferred translation subalgebra. And this is work that I did together with Kartik Prabhu, and we're still, you know, working on this with a master's student a postdoc in Prague. And there are many future applications, including, you know, studying the next order structure. So figuring out, you know, where is the gravitational radiation hidden? Can we figure out, you know, and study rigorously gravitational radiation produced by compact sources in cosmological spacetimes? Can we study the gravitational memory effect? How do we define charges and fluxes? How do we give them physical interpretations? Is there a preferred notion of mass and linear momentum? Or just, you know, maybe the take is no, there isn't, and just deal with it. And is there a way to link, you know, null infinity to time-like future infinity? And of course, you know, any of your favorite topics. Maybe, you know, some of you can figure out how to quantize these spacetimes based on the symmetries and all these other things. I look very much forward to figure out what your interests are and how you can apply these things. Thank you for listening, and I'm very happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Beatrice. Thank you for the talk. And we're going to start with questions from students.
Oh, that's such a nice BI tradition. I like that.
Yeah. So, let me see if I see all the participants. So if someone has a question in the chat. How things are gonna change for the case of accelerating universe?
Great question. Things are really drastically different for the accelerating case, because you no longer have a non-finity, but all your radiation ends up at an affinity, it's still called a non-finity, but the surface is no longer null. So it's maybe not a great name. So Scry is now a space-like surface. And because of that, you lose a lot of the structure, right? A space-like surface has a normal vector that's really orthogonal to it. Whereas if you have a null surface, the null vector is, you know, also ruling the null surface, so to say. And that buys you a lot of extra structure. So that case is really very, very different. And many people have studied it and from different approaches. And also consequently, different approaches, different assumptions end up with very different conclusions. But the takeaway is, in those cases, you do not have anything that looks like BMS. You get different symmetry groups, and none of them are BMS-like.
Yeah, Amir, I think, let us know if you want some more details on that. And Hongwei asks, how do you think the stuff like soft theorem, do you expect them? Do you expect some soft theorem?
Great. Yeah, this is a good question. Let me not speculate on that. I bet there are more experts in the crowd that have something better to say about this. Yeah, but this is certainly an interesting direction to think about.
Okay, so Latam, you have a question, I see. So go for it.
Hi, Beatrice.
Hi.
So in the De Sitter case, have people looked at whether, you know, I mean, so the infinity isn't null, but the horizon around any given observer is a null surface. Is that might that have behavior more analogous to these null boundaries?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Yes, people have tried sort of. In that case, things are subtle, right? Because it's not guaranteed that you have such an horizon. Because you might expect things like caustics and things like that. So you may not actually have the existence of an horizon. But in case you can define things, people have tried to do things there, but it's still sort of work in progress, I have to admit. Certainly if you go around, you know, do linear perturbation theory, then things are much easier, but also less interesting, right?
Okay, I don't, okay, thanks.
We have a question by Adam.
Yeah, thanks Beatrice for the nice talk. I'm wondering, so I guess you showed that you get these BMS-like structures for single fluid component decelerating universes. But if I have a more realistic universe with, you know, multiple fluids, different s at different points in time, maybe even a late time period of acceleration, can you do this construction? Or if I have like just matter and radiation, for example?
Yeah, this is a great question. I have not shown that explicitly, that you can do this with a multiple fluid system. I expect you can, possibly with some, possibly you would need to change the value of S as you go along scry, possibly, right, that you have to make a dynamic. But I expect that it would either fit within this approach or with some minimal assumption or, you know, minimal modifications, it would fit in this approach. Yeah.
Great, thanks.
There's a question by Aldo. You are muted, Aldo.
Sorry. Hi, Beatrice. So I had two questions. One is about this mapping from asymptotically flat to asymptotically FRW spacetimes.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how constructive that is, and if what happens if you take Schwarzschild and map it across something like that.
Ah, good. What you would end up with.
Yeah.
This is a great question. I probably should know the answer. I think you end up with something. I could be wrong, but I think you end up in, if you do this mapping, this constructive mapping, with a space time with a particular type of stress energy tensor that not necessarily has any
mm-hmm.
obvious interpretation.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. I do know that people, you know, have tried to look for, right, solutions of black holes in cosmological contexts and have tried to use this trick of conformal mappings and things like that. And
yeah, okay.
People have not been successful in this sense.
Mm-hmm. And if I can ask another one, I was wondering about how I think it's related to your comments about the existence of killing vectors and the fact that FRW is homogeneous, and how you see these on scry. And so I was thinking, trying to understand how to think of this tau. So this tau seems to be a vector on the sphere, I suppose. This is kind of breaking my rotation symmetry. There's some preferential direction on the sphere. And so I was thinking, just trying to understand, I start from an homogeneous stress energy tensor and end up with this thing that is definitely not homogeneous. So, or maybe it is in some weird way. And I will, yeah,
if you can. Very nice. Yeah, so it would totally be true if this tau was sort of pointing in some preferred direction, but tau also changes depending on the type of conformal completion you choose. So if you choose a different omega, you're pointing in a different direction. So tau is both sort of, well, capturing matter and the type of conformal completion you use. So, yeah.
I
answered your question already, right?
No, I think I get what you... I need to think, but thanks. I think it's helpful. It's an helpful one.
If not, feel free to email me.
Is there another question by a student or faculty or postdoc? Oh, if not, I think we can thank Beatrice one time again for the nice talk.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for the very clear talk. It was very nice. And I'm curious to see what you're going to do with this BMS cosmology. I mean, I guess it's the matter is the most problematic part, right? Like,
yes, absolutely.
Because the metric, I think, it's quite easy to generalize with like a kind of your boundary metric to be arbitrary on time and everything. That's kind of, this part is okay for Friedman, Robertson, Walker metric, but the matter is the tricky part, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Really, the matter is what also makes all the calculations very difficult. So even, you know, if you go to or construct different types of coordinates, with just to gain intuition and, you know, play around, then you get very frustrated very easily just because there are many terms. And
yeah, 4D. Yeah, Aldo?
I don't know anything about this. It's just something that I think I heard when I was a PhD student, so it might be completely off track. But someone was, if I remember correctly, trying to see if one can generalize the, or better rephrase, the Copernican principle that tells you that F or W should be, you should look for homogeneous solutions of the cosmological, of the, yeah, for the cosmological problem, you're looking for homogeneous solutions. But the point is that to do that, you need to introduce some foliation. So you are on these space-like surfaces, which are not very, I don't know, very satisfactory in certain ways. And so then this person, who I don't remember who it was, was saying, oh, maybe we should look at these on along like a sort of homogeneity along the light-like directions or something like that. And here you have a way to go to light-like infinity and say things asymptotically look homogeneous in some sense. And so maybe, but you started from F or W as a starting point. So I don't know, there is kind of a, it's not exactly what this guy was proposing, but is some, in a way it goes halfway there, because I don't know, maybe it can be used, this technique of looking at things that are asymptotically something and generalizing them to, I don't know, implement that idea, which might have already been implemented. It was a more random thought.
Fun. I wasn't aware of that idea.
I tried to dig up who that was. I have very vague memories. It was a long time.
Yeah, sorry to come back with the matter. Like, because here you just assume that the matter has like, so universe dominated by matter or radiation or whatever. Like, but do you expect a big, because you require the matter to be isotropic, that's why it doesn't decay at infinity, right? Or something. But
yeah.
Just that, like, for example, if you add just, I guess, a Maxwell field, maybe that's, or something you can also like require to have like electric charge well defined or whatever, like that also you have some decay there, and then maybe there is a way to make sense of like to have a more protected, I mean protected in a sense, flat asymptotic region. I don't know if like which restriction on the matter would make sense, or probably it will spoil the fact that it's I'm not used to think about cosmology. That's why I'm not.
No, you're so right. Cosmology really makes it way more messy. If I were to say, well, you know, start with FLW and you just add a Maxwell field, that Maxwell field is totally fine. Like, it will decay. You're good. But somehow else, or at least to me, it seems very interesting to also think about the cosmological context, right? In the end, we do live.
No, I totally agree with you. I mean, like, because in the cosmology, like this kind of thing, you will have matter field the entire space time. And so probably it makes sense that the stuff diverge when you integrate them, because you integrate over an infinite thing if they don't decay. I guess that's what is happening, right?
It's not just because of you're integrating. In a way, it's more like, it's more the fact that you approach scrying along null rays that makes it appear as if things are diverging, right? So it's, in a way, I mean, how you could think of it, right, as you approach scry, right, you can think of yourself as being sort of boosted very much, right? Like an observer that's boosted. And then to that observer, things would seem to diverge, right? Because matter seems to diverge, even though, you know, it's perfectly regular, but, you know, fine matter. I think it's more because of that than anything else.
Okay. So do you think there will be a way of, renormalize, maybe it's not the correct word, but just like to take all this boosting effect, or like, I don't know.
Yeah, so I think this divergence just has to be there. And I think you just want it to be of that particular form. So just to say, like, as whenever you have a stress energy tensor with this kind of diverging part, well, yeah, just subtract it indeed, in that sense, like renormalize.
Okay.
That is my take on it.
No, that's good. Yeah. And for like the, just for like the sitter part, when you want to be in the sitter. Yeah. I know, I mean, people have like worked the analog of BMS for this kind of space time. And the main difference is that you really have to let your boundary metric fluctuate because it's kind of your initial data, right? In the sitter. Like, I mean, you cannot fix
it. Yeah.
And so you have also like a kind of you can write a BMS type of group. So I wonder like if you could do the same game, but maybe the definition of the abstract definition you were using, that coordinate dependent, I don't know how that will work on the sitter. Maybe.
So I did work on that, and it's very difficult to, it's a fine balance. As soon as you try to, well, if you don't impose or copy paste the definition and you don't impose anything extra, you get like an infinite dimensional group, like there's with no structure to it at all, right? Like not just infinite dimensional like BMS, but really just but if you want to impose extra structure, which is often done in this approach where people say, okay, well, I'll allow the metric to fluctuate, but you know, only in these particular kind of ways. That is really hard to do in that geometric framework, and it's hard to, I know, relate to what people do in this coordinate framework and that, like, I have not seen a nice link yet, because typically if you start with the geometric framework, it's easy to derive you can derive the form of the coordinates, but the other way around is much harder, right? So if you have specific coordinates, geometrizing your setup, this is difficult.
Sorry, I'm asking you a question. Like, but that's DS, but like if you have an EDS, I guess that would be easier, right?
Yes, ADS is I think fairly well understood. Also because in ADS is very different, right? Because the boundary, you need to impose extra conditions there for the problem to be well-defined. And then there's some sort of, well, natural choices, but, you know, and with those natural choices, you do get, well, these extra input gives you something like that the asymptotic symmetry algebra should just be ADS.
Okay, good. Okay.
So, yeah, I know that situation is by far the cleanest and the clearest.
I think. for sure.
Maybe even simpler, I would say, than the flat case.
I think the point is, I think for EDS, the problem is like we don't understand what is radiation very much in EDS4. Like, you know, so you end up with like fixing a lot of things and you're like, okay, that's great, everything worked, but we would like to still like allow stuff to reach the boundary. I mean, you know, like radiation or something, and you kind of, what people were doing till now is freezing that part, right? To have a well-defined version in principle. But I think like in flat, you should give that up because you have stuff leaking through your
In ADS, we don't allow stuff to leak. We demand it to reflect
Exactly. So I think, I mean, or reflection. So I think that's definitely something that will be like, you know, interesting to develop. It's letting, I mean, I don't know what defining radiation even if, because. Yeah, I don't know, like in flat it's clear what you call radiation, but like in DS, because matter can really reach that part. So yeah, I think that there is still like this generalization has to be happening in ADS, and then it's messy, I think, because we didn't understand yet. That's true. Okay, yeah, I don't have any more questions, so sorry.
No, it's great, thank you. It's fun, you know, that that makes giving seminars fun, right? The questions afterwards.
Yeah, no, and yeah, I think, I'm also working on this kind of, the similar, I mean, VMS and asymptotic symmetries and so on. So it's nice when you're coming from a different approach. I mean, a bit different language. And so you bring a new thing that, new avenues to open, because I think like in the field, what we have done is just like, oh, we have been too restrictive. Let's be more general. And here, once again, it's like, oh, let's be more general about the kind of symmetry we are allowing, because that's the one natural that appear naturally in that thing. So I think it's, maybe something that we would have not seen directly in. Anyway, so.
Nice. Thanks for you in this perspective. Yeah.
So, yeah, no. I don't know, Aldo, if you have more question or. So, yeah. So. Thanks for your evening with us.
Oh, you're welcome. I hope I was coherent all throughout. I'm getting a bit tired,
Yeah, you were. It was super clear. I mean, for me, it was good. Super clear. So, cannot speak for the other. And people in the chat were saying thank you for your talk. So I think
that's nice.